Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. A television reporter and a cameraman were shot to death on live television Wednesday in Virginia by a gunman that authorities described as a disgruntled station employee. A second video of the shooting, apparently recorded by the killer, was posted on social media, even as police tried to locate the suspect. The suspect is Vester Lee Flanagan of Roanoke, Virginia, according to the police dispatch office. Law enforcement personnel were in pursuit in multiple vehicles following the suspect closely, according to the Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. We'll bring you more details on that story as the situation develops. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir is expected to sign a peace agreement with rebels Wednesday in Juba, despite reservations over issues like power sharing. The UN Security Council Tuesday threatened him with sanctions if he does not. Speaking to the council Tuesday, the UN Humanitarian Aid Chief Stephen O'Brien says he was outraged by ongoing rights abuses.
I am very concerned about the atrocities which continue to be reported. The scope and level of cruelty that has characterized the attacks against civilians suggests a deep depth of antipathy that goes beyond political differences.
Meanwhile, Wall Street opened sharply higher Wednesday after data showed U.S. orders for durable goods rose more than expected in July. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 393.31 points. The S&P 500 gained 41.58 points. The NASDAQ Composite added 132.58 points. That's 2.9% to 4,639.07. This is VOA News. German Chancellor Angela Merkel visited an asylum shelter in eastern Germany Wednesday to meet with refugees, aid workers, and local officials as Europe struggles with the flood of asylum seekers fleeing violence in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Ms. Merkel will attend a Vienna summit with Balkan state leaders Thursday on European integration, but the immigration crisis is expected to be high on the agenda. The German chancellor called on European states to implement joint asylum agreements. Ms. Merkel says, we're talking registering minimum standards of accommodation and minimum standards of health care. Officials said Tuesday that record numbers of migrants entering Hungary, as well as arriving in many other parts of Europe. The UN Refugee Agency is calling on all governments to respond compassionately to this human tide of people who have been displaced from their homeland and are now seeking safety. NATO said two gunmen wearing Afghan Defense Forces uniforms attacked a military compound in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province Wednesday, shooting a vehicle and killing two coalition service members. A NATO statement said coalition troops returned fire, killing both of the shooters. North Korea has reduced its military readiness posture, South Korea said Wednesday. It comes after the two sides reached a deal to defuse tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The North lifted its self-described quasi-state of war following the Tuesday agreement, according to official confirmation, adding that Seoul reciprocated by relaxing its own defense stance. Under the accord, North Korea expressed regret about a recent landmine explosion that injured two South Korean soldiers. In return, Seoul turned off its propaganda broadcasts into the North. India and Pakistani border security force chiefs are to meet in New Delhi next month, according to Pakistani officials. It comes days after the first high-level peace talks in years between the two countries collapsed. The chiefs of the Pakistani Rangers and the Indian Border Security Force are to meet in New Delhi from September 9th through the 13th, according to a statement released on Wednesday by the Pakistani Rangers. However, Indian officials were not immediately available to confirm the meeting. Saudi Arabia announced it had carried out four executions in different cities Wednesday morning, bringing the total number of judicial killings to 130 so far in 2015. That's a sharp rise on recent years. The three executions were of Saudi nationals convicted of murder. Most of those executions in Saudi Arabia are done by public beheading. Analysts say it's not clear why the number of executions there has increased so much from last year. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The overall humanitarian situation continues sharply to deteriorate. As of today, over 2.2 million people have been displaced due to the conflict, an increase of 200,000 since the beginning of this year. Over 1.6 million are displaced internally, and over 616,000 people have fled to neighboring states.
That's Stephen O'Brien, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, describing conditions in South Sudan. His comments come as President Salva Kiir signs a peace deal to end the 20-month-long civil war. Details coming up.
Also in the news, at least 300 Muslim scholars and imams from Eastern African countries have met in Kenya to discuss ways to fight extremism in the region.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Egypt, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, South Sudan President Salva Kiir has belatedly signed a peace deal to end 20 months of civil war. However, at the signing ceremony in Juba, Mr. Kiir expressed what he called serious reservations about the agreement. The French news agency quotes him as saying the current agreement has so many things we have to reject. Mr. Kiir also said such reservations, if ignored, would not be in the interest of just and lasting peace. Rebel leader Riek Machar signed the peace deal last week, but President Kiir had asked for additional time to review it. The United Nations was poised to impose sanctions had Mr. Kiir not signed the agreement.
The UN Security Council received a bleak report yesterday on the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. Officials spoke of atrocities, human rights abuses, sexual assaults, and hunger. Ellen Margaret Loy is the head of the UN mission in South Sudan. She described the security situation as volatile and tense.
Fighting in the greater Upper Nile region has remained intense, and further escalation of hostilities in southern Unity State has had increasingly severe consequences for the civilian population. Major offensives conducted by the SPLA and its allied militias into opposition-held areas have led to further deterioration of the security and humanitarian situation since April, and have resulted in numerous reports of grave human rights violations. Most recently, on the 19th of August, fighting occurred between SPLA and opposition forces around Lea town, with both sides trading accusations of having initiated the attack. In Upper Nile State, heavy fighting between the SPLA and the SPLMA in opposition, along with its allied Shilluk militia, has centered around the state capital, Malakal, which has changed hands several times since April.
Loy said the escalation of violence around the country has sparked further displacement. Many have sought UN protection.
UNMISS is now providing protection to over 200,000 internally displaced persons at 6 protection of civilian sites. The Benchu site has experienced the largest recent increase in internally displaced persons, up by 140% since late April, while the population at the Malakal site has grown by almost 50% just since mid-July. The escalation of fighting also sparked violent tensions between Dinka, Nuer, and Shilluk internally displaced persons within the Malakal site. The large influx of internally displaced persons into UNMISS bases during the reporting period and the resulting rise in political, ethnic, and tribal tensions, as well as criminal activity in the camps, underscores once again the unsustainability of these protection sites for the longer term.
The head of mission in South Sudan said all parties in the conflict have an utter disrespect for human life. She also raised concerns about limitations placed on the media, including threats and violence and the recent murder of journalist Peter Mowi. Also testifying yesterday before the UN Security Council was Stephen O'Brien, Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs. He just returned from South Sudan.
The overall humanitarian situation continues sharply to deteriorate. As of today, over 2.2 million people have been displaced due to the conflict, an increase of 200,000 since the beginning of this year. Over 1.6 million are displaced internally, and over 616,000 people have fled to neighbouring states. Almost 200,000 IDPs are now seeking refuge in UNMISS bases, compared to 121,000 just 4 months ago. Severe food insecurity is affecting 4.6 million people this year, compared to 3.8 million at the height of the lean season last year. While WFP and its partners have reached more than 2.3 million in 2015, severe hunger will be a threat well into next year, especially if fighting continues.
O'Brien said the lives of more than 250,000 children are at risk of rapidly worsening malnutrition. There have also been large spikes of malaria cases, particularly affecting pregnant women and children under five. O'Brien also said atrocities continue to be reported in South Sudan.
The scope and level of cruelty that has characterized the attacks against civilians suggests a deep depth of antipathy that goes beyond political differences. Allegations include rampant killing, rape, abduction, looting, arson, and forced displacement, and even such horrific acts as burning of people inside their own homes. There is evidence of deliberate ethnic targeting of and reprisals against women and girls. According to information received from Unity, hundreds of women and girls have been abducted and hundreds more have been subjected to sexual violence, including gang rape. For example, a survivor from Koch County reported how she was dragged out of her tukul and gang raped alongside her neighbour by government soldiers in front of her three-year-old child. In another instance, witness from Rubikoni County has said that she saw government forces gang raping a breastfeeding mother after tossing her baby aside. Those who can flee from this unspeakable violence hide in the hard-to-reach swamp lands, while some others make the long journey by foot to the Bentu Protection of Civilian site in search of safety.
The UN Undersecretary General said nearly 30 humanitarian workers have been killed over the last 20 months. Many more have been wounded or abducted. O'Brien also says there's been a sharp rise in robberies at NGO compounds. He said any peace agreement must include the protection of civilians. O'Brien added that much more funding is needed for humanitarian operations, saying only half of financial requirements have been met this year.
And I am concerned that without timely and sustainable funding, we will not be able to deliver on our promise to enable the people of South Sudan to realise their basic right to be safe, live with dignity, and free from want.
Stephen O'Brien is Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs.
In related news, two aid workers with the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, were killed in South Sudan's Unity State last week. Ian Bohr reports the deaths occurred amid fighting between government forces and rebels.
Aid workers Guar Top Pyoy and James Gatluak Gutpien worked for MSF in Southern Unity State for several years. Last week, they were killed in separate attacks, even as international mediators and negotiators for both sides in South Sudan's conflict put the finishing touches on a deal to end 20 months of fighting in the country. Jacob Kuhn is the MSF spokesman in Juba.
We're deeply saddened and shocked by the death of our colleagues, and it's just a sign, one sign of the impact of ongoing violence in the region surrounding Lair.
Kuhn says even though the final peace deal has been in the works for weeks now, there has been no let-up in fighting in parts of South Sudan, including Southern Unity State. He says civilians are still bearing the brunt of violence, and MSF staff are working flat out to provide medical aid to people in need.
Displacement continues. Violence against civilians continues. We've treated 50 patients for gunshot wounds in the last 30 days. Some of them have been pregnant women. They've been children. Violence against civilians needs to stop.
Keane says last week's incidents were not the first time aid workers have been attacked in Unity State.
Several of our staff members around Lair who fled in May to seek shelter in the bush, they were also remain unaccounted for. MSF has only intermittent contact with those national staff. There was an instance several weeks ago, an attack on Dabluwal, in which one of our former staff was shot in the face.
Keane says access to health care in southern Unity State is extremely limited. MSF was forced to abandon the majority of its projects in southern Unity State back in May when fighting intensified.
We've only recently been able to resume operations in Lair, but with a very small team. The hospital there that used to serve a catchment area of 200,000 people as their only source of secondary medical care remains unfunctional. So Southern Unity MSF is deeply concerned, primarily for access to health care for the population who are displaced, who are affected by ongoing violence, including violence against civilians.
As of now, MSF only has a small mobile medical unit in Southern Unity State. But Kuhn hopes that with a peace deal now signed by all parties, fighting will die down in war-wracked parts of South Sudan, and it will be safe for MSF staff to resume the work of providing life-saving medical care to thousands of people in need. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel was booed today by far-right-wing protesters as she visited a center for refugees and asylum seekers. The French news agency says about 200 protesters demonstrated in the eastern town of Heidenau, where the center was set up in a former store. They called Merkel a traitor. Police and protesters clashed last weekend over the opening of the center. Germany is a prime destination for migrants and refugees crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa and those entering Greece to reach EU countries. Elsewhere, Reuters reports Hungarian police fired tear gas to disperse migrants in a camp near the Serbian border. Local TV reports say the migrants chanted for the UN to help them. Reports also say Hungary is reinforcing its southern border with mounted police, helicopters and dogs. Police say more than 2,500 migrants were caught yesterday entering Hungary through Turkey. Another 1,300 were captured today. Most were from Syria, Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. At least 300 Muslim scholars and imams from Eastern African countries have met in Kenya to discuss ways to fight extremism in the region. After a two-day conference in the coastal county of Kwale, the clerics said they would join their respective governments in combating terrorist activities. Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
The scholars of the Sufi sect of Islam from Kenya, Tanzania, Somalia, Ethiopia, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo have vowed to fight extremism teachings and terrorist activities. Speaking to reporters after the two-day conference in Kwale, US-based Somali scholar Mohamud Ilmi said there has to be a counter-narrative to fight extreme views in schools.
We have to put what is called a religious syllabus that supports the people of different faiths and values.
Ilmi called on Muslims in the region to work with their governments to squash terrorism, which has claimed the lives of thousands in Somalia and neighbouring countries. The end of the two-day conference came just a day after Kenyan security forces recovered weapons and arrested dozens of terror suspects believed to be planning an attack in Garissa town. Police officials say some of the suspects were Tanzanians. In April, five gunmen stormed Garissa University College, killing more than 140 people, mostly students. Sheikh Omar Mohammed of Tanzania says such acts of violence create rifts and divisions among the people.
Na sisi kama Waislamu tumeweza kufanya kazi yetu ya Uislamu kwa amani.
He says that as Muslims we are able to do our religious duties peacefully, and our governments have given us freedom of worship. He says we will not allow sectarian violence and unrest in our countries. The Somali-based Sufi sect known as Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah consists of moderate Sufis opposed to radical Islamist groups such as Al-Shabaab. But some experts say it will need a collective effort, and the group's followers will need time to defeat deep-rooted extreme teachings and terrorist activities. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
For more than 30 years, coffee production has been industrialized in major coffee-growing countries in Latin America. The trend has increased production and lowered the price for growing northern coffee drinking markets. A University of Kansas sociologist says technified coffee that is grown on large, highly irrigated farms has helped lower the world price of unroasted bean. However, African smallholders who continue to grow their beans in small shade tree tradition manage to compete by growing specialized coffee varieties for the world. Alexander Myers discussed the implications of technified coffee for Africa with VOA's David Arnold.
Technification is scaling up of traditional coffee production that's done in smaller plantations that use shade trees. And technification is when you strip away the shade trees and grow coffee in full sun, which makes it much more productive, but also increases the environmental impact.
What are the environmental impacts?
It was originally cultivated for consumption in Ethiopia. It actually is one of the most biodiverse and vibrant kind of ecological systems that we know about that also produces something that humans can use.
What other African countries are affected by this change in the manner in which we grow coffee?
Technification as a process was begun in Latin America in the early 1950s, and then it kind of spread through Latin America during the 70s and 80s as the kind of new way of growing coffee. The geography of Latin America is a little bit more conducive to technified coffee.
What are the reasons for technification of coffee growing, for example, in Latin America?
It basically increases the amount of coffee that you can get from a given hectare of land. It increases it by several magnitudes, but it also requires a lot more input. So coffee doesn't naturally grow in these full sun environments. It's only grown in shade. So that can be a significant, it can have significant impacts on, so water use, for instance. If it's in full sun, the water evaporates more quickly when it's irrigated, and it's harder on the plant. So the plant extracts more resources from the soil, more nutrients from the soil. So it requires a lot more fertilizer and a lot more pesticide to grow. Since it produces so much, it drives the price down. And so the price since the early to mid-1990s has fluctuated dramatically. It'll go on very high highs, and then it'll go down to the lowest reported commodity coffee price, 47 cents. Per pound for green coffee, and that's what it's trading for on the stock market. We haven't seen a whole lot of technification in African countries that export coffee.
Does that mean that it's more difficult for the African growers to compete?
Very definitely, yes. That's a big problem because it's kind of a what economists call a race to the bottom. It forces everyone else to grow coffee more cheaply, or else they lose their ability to sell it.
If the geography of Africa is not as conducive to technification as it is in Latin America, are there other options that African growers have to remain competitive in the price structure, the cost of coffee to consumers?
One of the big movements in coffee consumption in the West in the past 10 or 15 years has been specialty coffees. So fair trade or Sony and bird certified coffee that's grown specifically to kind of as a very high quality product, as a niche product that consumed, it's usually more expensive. And so that has been a big change in coffee consumption. And producers have begun meeting that demand, which affords them a lot more. They can get a lot more money per pound of coffee for this very high-quality coffee. It's not an ultimately sustainable solution, but it is something that a lot of producers have adopted, trying to sell this very high-quality coffee at a higher price.
And what has happened to the coffee industry in Latin America under technification?
It's forced out a lot of the smallholders, so the people who own, you know, a small plot of land that they farm coffee and then usually other crops. And it's forced them to either adopt this kind of model of large scale, much more expensive to grow, or else, you know, give up their land.
That was researcher Alexander Myers speaking from the United States of Kansas to VOA's David Arnold.
Warming oceans will cause profound changes in the biodiversity of marine life, according to the largest study ever conducted of marine species. Some species will expand into new regions, while others, especially in the tropics, are likely to face extinction. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, these predictions are a call to protect the ocean and the food it provides.
The study included nearly 13,000 species across the Earth's oceans and used a model that looked at temperature changes at the sea surface, then compared that information with data on individual species' heat tolerance and habitat preferences. It predicts the tropics will be hardest hit with species extinction, but other species will survive by expanding their range. That has a downside, says co-author Professor John Pandolfi from the ARC Center of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies at Australia's University of Queensland.
So instead of having discrete differentiation of different marine communities in different places, we found in our analysis that projected climate change is going to result in a lot more mixing of species and a lot more sameness of diversity throughout the world's oceans.
The study charts these changes out to the year 2100. Pandolfi says that sameness in the ocean is especially problematic as we consider new strategies to meet the food demands of a growing population.
It could be that species that were very abundant in the past and they're good at tracking environments, when they invade a new ecosystem or a new geographic region, they're not the top dogs anymore, or they might not be able to reproduce as effectively as they used to. It comes down to a sense of understanding the dynamism that's going to be imposed from climate change and being able to have the tools to manage for those dynamics.
Unless global emissions are controlled, the planet and its oceans will continue to heat up, releasing the impacts predicted in the study. Pandolfi warns the new combinations of resident and migrant species will present unprecedented challenges for conservation planning.
And that's something I think that you know, isn't easy for people to get their heads around, because you think, oh, you know, I'm going to set up a marine park here so I can make sure that these organisms are preserved through, you know, through decades or centuries. But in fact, with climate change, those communities are going to change. They're going to be dynamic. They're not going to be static entities.
In the warmer oceans, species will cross into new geographic areas beyond political boundaries. Pandolfi says the study, published in Nature Climate Change, underscores the importance of cooperation among nations to address climate change and the potential loss of biodiversity. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan President Salva Kiir belatedly signs a peace deal to end 20 months of civil war. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was booed by far right-wing protesters as she visited a center for refugees and asylum seekers today. And at least 300 Muslim scholars and imams from Eastern African countries met in Kenya to discuss ways to fight extremism in the region. Coming up, we'll have music from Egypt, and in our feature segment, refugees from Somalia who fled to Yemen to escape war and poverty are facing similar turmoil in their adopted country. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand that World Athletics tops your sports report today.
Kim, Kenya remains firmly on top of the medals table at the World Athletics Championships in China after winning gold Wednesday in the men's javelin and the women's 3,000-meter steeplechase. Ladies first. Haivan Jepkemoi won her first world title in the steeplechase, clocking 9 minutes and 19.11 seconds in Beijing. Tunisia's Habib Griebi won the silver medal, and Gesa Kraus of Germany won the bronze medal. The 23-year-old Jepkemoi ran her first competitive 3,000-meter steeplechase race at the 2011 All-Africa Games in Maputo, Mozambique, where she won the gold. Now she can proudly add a world championship gold medal to her trophy cabinet. Jepkemoi's Kenyan teammate Julius Yego also won a gold medal at the 2011 All-Africa Games. The javelin thrower followed that up with another gold at the 2014 Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, Scotland. And on Wednesday in Beijing, Julius won his first world title with a throw of 92.72 meters. That's the best distance in the world this year. And Egyptian Ihab Abdelrahman El Said won the silver medal, throwing the javelin just under 89 meters. Meanwhile, South Africa won gold Wednesday in the men's 400 meters race. In the final event of the day, Wade Van Niekerk won gold when he hit the tape in 43.48 seconds, a personal best and the fastest time in the world this year. It was South Africa's first medal at Beijing 2015. After 5 days of action at the World Championships, Kenya tops the medals table with 6 gold, 3 silver and 2 bronze for a total of 11 medals. The Kenyans have won twice as many gold medals as Britain, which is second on the table with 3 gold. Jamaica is third on the medals table with 2 gold and 1 bronze and 3 medals. Cuba is fourth with 2 gold medals. And the United States is fifth with 1 gold, 3 silver and 5 bronze. And a total of 9 medals. Remember, VOA sports fans, even though the USA has won the second most medals total behind the Kenyans, gold has the most weight in the standings. So that's why the USA is currently in 5th place. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. Reporter Parker Morse in Beijing sent me a tweet regarding Kenya's performance at the World Championships. Parker writes, "Astoundingly successful championships for Kenya. That shining Kenyan success was clouded a bit on Wednesday, though, when 2 Kenyan athletes, Koki Manunga and Joyce Zakari, were provisionally banned by the International Association of Athletics Federations after testing positive for banned substances. The 29-year-old Zakari competes in the 400 meters event. She set a new Kenyan national record of 50.71 seconds in her first heat, but she did not run in the semifinals. The 21-year-old Manunga, meanwhile, did not qualify for the semifinals of the women's 400 meters hurdles event in Beijing. Both women were tested at the Kenyan team hotel before the World Championships began. Athletics Kenya, the governing body for the sport in the country, says it's already met with the IAAF and the athletes involved and is investigating the situation which led to the results. It says follow-up action will be taken in Kenya. Meanwhile, I'll follow up with more news from Beijing and the World Athletics Championships. But first, let's take a break for these Voice of America programming announcements.
Voice of America!
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA.
VOA!
And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to Sports Radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
In action Tuesday at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, Kenya won two gold medals in the men's 400 meters hurdles and the men's 800 meters races. In the 800 meters, Olympic champion and world record holder David Rudisha won his second world title, clocking 1 minute 45.84 seconds.
I think winning was the most important thing to me. And I knew that I'm still strong and I've proven that even I can win in a slow pace and I can win in a tactical race as well as the fast race. I can win right from the front. So this gives me more confidence. And as I'm looking forward to 2016 Rio Olympics, I think I'm very happy to be in such a shape.
David Rudisha looks like he's in great shape ahead of next year's Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Rudisha missed the 2013 World Championships in Moscow because of a knee injury, so Beijing 2015 once again showed that David Rudisha is the best, yes, the best two-lap runner in the world. Now, Rudisha has been asked a few times about the possibility of racing against Jamaican star Usain Bolt. And that question was again posed to him after his victory in Beijing.
Maybe in future, we never know how it's going to go, but it's very difficult for us to meet because Usain Bolt is a sprinter and I'm a middle distance athlete, so there's nowhere in between we can meet in any competition. But maybe in future, you never know, we might just have something for fun.
It would definitely be fun to watch Olympic and world champions David Rudisha and Usain Bolt run against each other. Maybe a special charity race is the answer. If any IAAF officials are listening tonight to the Sunny Side of Sports, consider that a special charity race between David Rudisha and Usain Bolt. I like that idea. I really like it. In the men's 400 meters hurdles final Tuesday, Kenyan policeman Nicholas Bett won his first world title. Nicholas's time of 47.79 seconds was a personal best and the fastest time in the world this year.
I'm surprised because I've run my best time and world. So now I'm happy because I've met Kenya to be a champion in long distance sprints. So I'm saying thanks to God because you have given me a lot of energy for sprints. Because you know the sprints is not a easy game. It's so hard from the word go until the finishing line. I say thanks to God.
World champion hurdler Nicholas Bett of Kenya speaking in Beijing, China. And I was talking to my friend Douglas Mpuga, the mighty Mpuga, before tonight's show. And I mentioned to Douglas that Kenya is really expanding its reach at these world championships in Beijing. We know Kenya is dominant at the distance runners, distance races, but we just heard from Nicholas Bett, a hurdler who won gold in Beijing, and also Julius Yago winning gold in the javelin. Those are not traditional power events for the Kenyans, but they're expanding, maybe specializing in other events. Now let's go to Tunisia for an update at the African Men's Basketball Championship. Senegal trounced Uganda Wednesday 79-48 to advance to the quarterfinals. And speaking of the mighty Mpuga, he was wincing. Yes, wincing when I read that result to him because he wants those Ugandans to advance. But they did not advance in Tunisia. The Senegalese are through to the round of eight. The Senegalese were led by Gorgui Dieng, who plays for the Minnesota Timberwolves in the National Basketball Association. Gorgui scored a game-high 23 points, and he also pulled down a game-high 17 rebounds. Stanley Ositi led the Ugandans with 16 points. Egypt, Angola, Mali, and host Tunisia are already through to the quarterfinal round. Let's take a look at some of the quarterfinal matchups that we know of already. In quarterfinal games Thursday, Egypt will play Angola, and Tunisia will host Mali. The semifinals at AfroBasket 2015 are scheduled for Saturday in Tunisia, and the final will be played on Sunday. Remember, VOA basketball fans, the winner of that final in Tunisia will be the African representative at next year's Olympic men's basketball tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a fish farming project in Zimbabwe. And next, refugees from Somalia who fled to Yemen to escape war and poverty are facing similar turmoil in their adopted country. But first, some music. Here is Aram Diab of Egypt with Waya. Aram Diab of Egypt with Waya.
Well, a fish farming project set up in Zimbabwe's Nyamwenda village in Manicaland province a few years ago has become a bedrock of conserving local wetlands while providing nutritious food to 28 households. As our correspondent Lorna Moyo reports, the fish program has even attracted unwanted visitors like birds that are feasting on fish.
It all started with fish worth $400 provided by Zimbabwe's Environmental Management Agency, or EMA, in their quest to preserve local wetlands that play a critical role in purifying the ecosystem. Our attempt to preserve the environment for future generations is now paying dividends as the fish project is flourishing and improving the quality of food in the local community. 47-year-old Tapiwa Charangwa, secretary of the Nyamwenda Wetland Protection and Fish Ponds, says local people are benefiting a lot from the project.
Because of this project, we are benefiting the balanced diet to our children and to us, then cash to our children, school fees, and maintain our wetlands.
Charangwa says many other people now want to be part of the project as they are seeing the benefits of fish farming. The abundant fish have attracted unwelcome guests, fishmonger birds, which she says raid their ponds mainly in summer.
The problem is that there is a big bird which comes to eat the fish. The fish will be on top of water feeding, and then that bird will come and eat the fish.
Another member of the fish project, 60-year-old Jane Charangwa, says despite this slight setback, they are gaining a lot from the fish ponds.
From this fishing, we benefit to feed our children, to treat ourselves from eyesight, to get energy and protein. You can even sell this fish, then you can get money from it. You can even send our children to school.
Charangwa believes that this is one of the best ways of empowering communities. The villagers are breeding kariba bream, which is one of the popular dishes in the local community. It also breeds well in some parts of Manicaland region, home of the Nyanga trout. EMA Manicaland Provincial Manager Kingston Chitotombe says they chose the Nyamwenda wetlands as the natural water bodies were under threat from overgrazing and illegal alluvial gold panning.
This wetland was degraded due to overgrazing. So as a way of preserving this wetland, we thought of giving the community fencing material. They fenced it. But to ensure that these communities protect this wetland, we're to introduce a livelihood component by way of fish ponds. So now this wetland is protected, and we are sure that this community is going to benefit from the fish.
Chitotombe says the project is a novel way of tackling environmental degradation and balancing people's diet.
In one way, we are protecting the wetland, then at the same time, communities are benefiting out of this wetland.
He says EMA is targeting other wetlands in the province with a view of ensuring that they are preserved while providing food to local people. Some wetlands in cities like Chitungwiza have been degraded through the construction of residential and commercial buildings. According to Chitotombe, a similar fish project would have saved the wetlands. Reporting from Nyamwenda village in Nyanga, this is Lloyd Amoyo.
Refugees from Somalia who fled to Yemen to escape war and poverty are facing similar turmoil in their adopted country. Now they want to return to their homeland. Abdulaziz Bilou has more.
This abandoned university in the port town of Mukalla has become home to thousands of Somali refugees and displaced Yemenis caught up in the conflict that has engulfed Yemen since early this year. Nurto, a mother of seven, has been living in Yemen for more than 12 years. She says she can no longer care for her children and wants to return to her native Somalia.
Since the fighting started, there's absolutely no way I could work. Everyone's on the run. Us, the Arabs, the United Nations. There was no one left to help us. We waited, hoping things will cool down, but it seems nothing changed. So we've decided to return to Somalia, whether we live or die.
Houthi rebels have been fighting the government in Yemen for nearly a year. However, Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations have launched airstrikes against the rebels, ousting them from a string of towns in southern Yemen. Mohammed Abdullahi, a Somali fisherman and a father of six, fled with his family from the port town of Aden. He is among the thousands who were trapped in the fighting.
I was a fisherman when I was living in Aden. I earned a living for my family through fishing. But once the fighting commenced, there was absolutely no way I could continue working. Me and my family were trapped in Aden for more than 3 months.
A ship sent by Somalia's business community with the help of international aid agencies brings back more than 2,500 Somalis. They boarded the ship for a 30-hour voyage from Mukalla to the Somali town of Bosaso. Most were women, young children, and the elderly. In Somalia at last, their hope is that the federal government will resettle them and guarantee their security so they can build a better life in coming years. Abdulaziz Bilo for VOA News, Bosaso.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fostering economic development in sub-Saharan Africa is a top priority of the United States, and the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, is the centerpiece of our trade policy on the continent. Government officials, business leaders, and civil society from African countries and the U.S. are meeting in Gabon's capital, Libreville, this week to discuss how AGOA, now 15 years old, can provide even more business and investment opportunities for Africa's people today and into the future. Statistics support a growing consensus in both Africa and the United States that freer trade and increased international investment are critical to spurring economic development and reducing poverty. The U.S. Congress enacted AGOA in May 2000, providing a wide range of African products duty-free access to the U.S. market. AGOA has succeeded in helping eligible nations grow, diversify their exports to the United States, and create employment and inclusive economic growth. By 2014, African countries' non-oil AGOA exports to the United States were valued at $4.4 billion, up roughly 250% from 2001. The growth of these non-oil industries has spurred an estimated 300,000 direct jobs in beneficiary countries. AGOA's success won overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress, which this summer voted to reauthorize the program for another 10 years. That underscores our nation's commitment to a stronger U.S.-Africa trade relationship and support for the region's long-term economic growth. The new AGOA legislation has an added clause, specifically calling for the promotion of the role of women in social, political, and economic development in sub-Saharan Africa. This acknowledges the vital role that women play as economic and civic leaders across the continent. Discussions during this year's forum will explore ways to build strong, export-oriented businesses and prepare African women producers to integrate more fully into regional and global supply chains. The 2015 forum will provide an opportunity to celebrate the recent reauthorization of AGOA, take stock of its successes over the last 15 years, look to the next 10, and launch a dialogue on our shared vision for the future of U.S.-Africa trade.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.